From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm David Hyde. New Yorker writer Adam Gopnik has a new book out about the meaning of food. Adam Gopnik's new book is called The Table Comes First, Family, France, and the Meaning of Food. Adam Gopnik, thanks so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be here, David.
So I wanted to start out with the whole locavore, slow food thing that you talk about in this book, because this is Seattle, this is the West Coast, and we're very interested in that here. We're serious about it. You decided to do this experiment just in the five boroughs of Manhattan, which is, it seems like extreme locavorism.
That's extreme with a big X at the beginning.
Why did you go there?
I got the locavore bug around the same time, middle of the last decade, and everybody was getting it. And I thought, wouldn't it be fun to see if, you know, people talk about the food shed and eating just the local stuff, if you could actually eat for a week or maybe just a weekend from New York City and just the five boroughs, nothing from outside. And sure enough, we found there are three working farms in New York, and we got, and actually one of the working farms in New York and Brooklyn is fertilized with elephant dung taken from the Bronx Zoo. So you actually get, I thought at first when they told me that, I thought it was like the joke you tell reporters, but true enough. There's a kind of mad scientist with tilapia in tanks down at Brooklyn College. And we
tilapia
did
is that,
that kind of slightly tasteless but very good for you fish. They always say it's the fish they served at the Last Supper. How they know that, I don't know. But it's like instantly when someone says tilapia, they say it was the fish that was served at the Last Supper. And we just did it as to see. Actually, I was trying to get a chicken, a local chicken, a chicken in the Bronx. And I actually went, David, to the point of trying to arrange a contract on a chicken, trying to get somebody to whack a Bronx chicken for me. But he refused to do it. So we ended up with a Pennsylvania raised but New York slaughtered chicken. But the point, what I was trying to do is partly I was just having fun with it. I thought it would be cool and neat to see what you could do. But also I was trying to make a slightly serious point, and that is that it seems to me the real appeal of local eating and the whole locavore movement isn't so much that it's virtuous, that it, we can prove that we're saving carbon miles, because as you probably know, that's a very controversial proposition. And there are lots of strong arguments on the other side that actually spreading agriculture across the planet is actually probably a more efficient way of doing it. Classic arguments about the division of labor and so on. There are lots of to be said on both sides of it, and it's worth saying. But the heart of the thing that I thought really mattered was that whatever its virtues, there's something terrific about putting a face on your food. The look on my two kids' faces when they realized for the first time in their lives that peppers come from under the ground, when they dealt with the reality that a chicken is not something that comes wrapped up in plastic that you find in the supermarket, but is a living thing that has to be slaughtered and bled and have its feathers taken off. Those things are in themselves valuable, whatever, however the larger question about carbon miles and local eating is decided. And that, David, is really the theme of this book. It's about meaningful pleasure. It's about saying, look, what goes on around the table is terribly important as what's on the table, and that the pleasure we take in eating should be pleasure, that we should treat it as a pleasure, because pleasure's not an infallible guide to goodness, but it's the least fallible of all the guides I know.
New Yorker writer Adam Gopnik is here. His new book is The Table Comes First. So how ultimately was the food? I mean,
I made the one rule that my kids made, because they were very suspicious, is no pigeon and no squirrel, because they figured that I might try and sneak that in as protein. I kept telling them, I was teasing them, saying, you know, in Italy, pigeon is regarded as a very great delicacy. But the food was good. I made a big, great big dinner for everybody, and we had lots of good local herbs and so on. It was a wonderful dinner. And it was a wonderful dinner because of the effort that had gone into making it. It was just a reflection of the exceptional effort. You know, it's like most of our pleasures are keener if they have some kind of restraint, some kind of constraint around them. And one of the truths about American abundance, for good or ill, is that there are very few constraints, seasonal constraints, local constraints, any kind of constraints on what we eat. And when you put constraints on something, generally, you take more pleasure in it than when you just do it in a completely undisciplined way.
You also have some ambivalence about the slow food movement and the locavore movement. Tell us a little bit about that.
I do. Ambivalence is the right word, David. On the one hand, I completely subscribe to it. I'm a guy who's doing 7-hour lamb on a Sunday. I try and get nothing but grass-fed beef, and if I find that my kids have brought a box of Fruit Loops or Honey Nut Cheerios into the cupboard, I react like Carrie Nation. You know, I run around with a tomahawk and say, who brought that in? I have all of those tastes. But I also recognize that those are the tastes of our time. And I recognize, too, there's something a little bit dubious about the claim that there's something inherently virtuous about the way peasants once ate, that if you're living just off the land, you're eating only the things that are near you. There's something in it that shows a kind of a dislike for a cosmopolitan, exotic experience. And one of the truths about civilization is that it's made up of people trading foodstuffs. It's made up through the trade of spices. That's one of the great ways that the planet got civilized, wasn't just by people focusing. That's what people were forced to do through centuries of famine. And one of the ways the human imagination got liberated was by the exchange of spices in every sense, the exchange of foodstuffs. That's how civilizations grow.
New Yorker writer Adam Gopnik's new book is The Table Comes First, Family, France, and the Meaning of Food. Is there a case to be made, do you think, for mass-produced food or industrial food?
Well, you know, we're trying to feed a very hungry and very large planet. How many people now? 7 billion. The 7th billionth was born. And we need to look squarely at the reality that, as I said a moment ago, we live in an age of relative abundance, not absolute abundance, and certainly not evenly distributed abundance. And those are all things that are real problems that have to be fixed. But there is a case to be made, I think. And throughout this book, David, I try as best I can to walk around these issues. That is to say, let's look at all of the kinds of rational cases that can be made pro or con rather than polemicize too passionately for one view. So you can say, and I think with a great deal of justice, that the system of agriculture, of industrial agriculture, is despoiling the planet, ruining us, that if we want to do something good for the ecology, stopping eating meat is one of the first good things we can do. At the same time, we're trying to feed an enormous number of people, and being a Puritan about it, being too refined to think about how many more people are eating better, living longer, sometimes living shorter, but because of advances in agriculture, I think that's a form of denial too. And like most things in life, it's not the most dramatic thing you can say, but it happens to be the most truthful. The truth lies someplace in between. We should recognize and encourage the kind of mass food that we have, and we also should try and discipline it so it doesn't become a burden on our hearts or on the planet.
So what's the Adam Gopnik edited version of how the slow movement should look?
I think we should do it because it tastes good. We should do it because it gives us pleasure. We should do it because it puts constraints on our pleasure that increases our pleasures. Not because we are in possession of some fixed dogma that says this is the right way to eat and anybody who doesn't share it is eating the wrong way. There is no right way to eat. The right way to eat changes with every generation.
Adam Gopnik is here. His new book is The Table Comes First. You also write about the restaurant.
Yeah.
And tell us about when it started. When did restaurants get going? I was kind of surprised because I thought, haven't restaurants always been around?
You know, it's one of those things. It's like having sex in beds. You'd think that's something that's always been there. Right? Nobody had to think of that idea. And you'd feel the same way. Eating, paying for food at little tables with a menu, you think that's always been there. And one of the things that astonished me was I was researching this book. I hate that verb, but studying for this book was that the restaurant emerges at a very particular moment, right around 1780, just before the French Revolution in Paris. It takes its name from the first thing that was served there, the restaurant, a kind of restorative bouillon, like a broth. And it was a kind of health food. And one of the key things, David, that it did was that it gave a license to unmarried women to be in the same room with free men. And so you had an open, sort of open social space. It's, you know, we always use health in that way, right? That's why you can go to your gym semi-dressed and be alongside other people who are semi-dressed. And it's not salacious. It's just salubrious. It's just for your health. You're doing it for your health. Same thing was true about the birth of the restaurant. And all of our restaurant traditions come out of that one kind of eureka moment in France around 1780.
What else do you see in addition to women now they're in public space?
Yes, so
what else is revolutionary about the restaurant?
Well, that was one thing. The other thing is that it sits on a kind of fine edge because on the one hand, it's a bourgeois institution. It's all about money. On the other hand, and people said this at the time, it was a democratizing institution because before then, good food was the special province of the aristocrats. You had to belong to an aristocratic family or to a court to get it. At the restaurant, for the first time, anybody with enough shekels in his pocket could go in and get what he chose to eat. That may not strike us now as a big democratic advance, but it really is. Another thing that was new in restaurants, especially after the French Revolution, is that you could get spirits, wine and caffeine in the same space, in the same place. And if you think about it, all of our restaurant meals to this day are built around kind of the two bumpers of wine at one end, coffee at the other end, with the meal sort of stretched like a suspension bridge between them.
And I wanted to get to wine in a minute, but one other thing that you write, you have this provocative phrase about the restaurant, a semi-private state of eating in a restaurant. Yes. What's the significance of that?
Let me make it very particular. You know, I'm on the road a lot. We call it the perpetual tuition tour in my family. And one of the things that's true is that you end up eating alone in restaurants a lot. Now, some people find that very sad. They don't like to do that. I love to do it because what can give you more pleasure than being able to combine the anonymity of being a stranger in a place and being an observer, not being known at all? I like to go into a little restaurant in Seattle, Portland, wherever I am, with a good book and sit there. You're taking part in a social thing. There are people who are as close to you as you are to me right now, and we're sharing a space. I see what they're eating. I'm aware of them, and yet I keep my anonymity. I think that's part of the pleasure of being a modern person in a modern city. You know, I've never, you know, that famous painting by Edward Hopper, The Nighthawks, right, with all the people in the thing. I've never understood why that's supposed to be sad. It always looks to me like a positive scene, right?
People. So the common criticism, you know, modernity is alienating, and this is something new, right? I mean, is there anything lost for you? There's no
remorse. Of course
there's
losses. Life is full of losses and parallel gains. Right. Of course, modernity is alienating, and it leaves many of us very lonely. But modernity also gives us the great gift of anonymity, which you don't have in the village and you don't have in the tribe, where everybody knows your name and your business at every moment. Great gift of being able to say, I am a spy on my own experience. I am a secret person.
New Yorker writer Adam Gopnik's new book is The Table Comes First, Family, France, and the Meaning of Food. Another person that you write about in this book is Elizabeth Pennell.
Yes.
Who was she?
Elizabeth Pennell is a now almost completely unknown English, American-born food writer of the late 19th century who wrote a wonderful collection of recipes, really, food pieces called The Diary of a Greedy Woman. Now, that may not strike us right now as so revolutionary, but think the end of the 19th century when a woman had to either be domestic or had to be a good wife. For her to say, I love food because I have a huge sensual appetite. I am a greedy woman. It was really a revolutionary thing. So I loved her book, and I got to thinking, here was a woman around 1900 claiming the right to be greedy, to be sensual, have an appetite. And here I am, a man around the year 2000, who does lots of feminine things. I cook every night. I'm the one who does the shopping and the cooking. So I imagine a kind of email conversation between Elizabeth Pennell, long gone, of course, in 1900, and myself now, talking about the ironies and changes in food culture in the intervening century.
You also admire her take on gluttony. Tell us about that.
Well, you know, there's a nice word in French. You know, you almost never say somebody's a gourmet in French. That's like an American word. You say they're gourmand, meaning they're greedy. And she loved greediness. You know, we don't like to identify ourselves as greedy, but something very positive about that, to say we have an active appetite for our pleasures. And of course, it's tied to, in her case, to a kind of sexual declaration. A woman who's prepared to say, I am greedy, is also prepared to say, by implication, I'm greedy for lots of other pleasures.
So what's your take on something like the Danish fat tax? And there's talk of these kinds of taxes coming about in New York City as well. I mean, where do you come down on that?
Listen, as I said before, I share all of those prejudices. I am a child of my time, as we all are. I worry about how much fat my kids eat. I think there's a lot to be said for it. On the whole, I think coercive laws of any kind should be minimal. We want the best way to get somebody to eat better is to show them how much better good food tastes, how much better it is for them. And I think that that's a better way of approaching it. It's obvious, though, at a deeper level, David, that we live within two food cultures, the one you and I are joking about, locavores and so on, and then the vast fast food culture, that supersize me culture that surrounds us, too. They're two very different kinds of cultures, and they have different problems and different points, I suppose. But I'm opposed to coercive legislation, but I think that the goal is the right one.
New Yorker writer Adam Gopnik is here, and his new book is The Table Comes First, Family, France, and the Meaning of Food. Another topic in this book you mentioned earlier is wine. You know, wine drinking is something that people kind of get, but you make the case here for wine writing. Why is that?
Well, wine is sort of the classic thing that shows how much our perceptions of food depend on the frames that we experience it in. You know, you put a label on a bottle of wine and say it's Chateau Lower Montana instead of Chateau Latour, and people, even wine experts, connoisseurs as we call them in my family, will rate it lower. They will. We're terribly affected by the context in which we experience things.
And that would give Calvin Trillin a lot of satisfaction.
Yes, yes. And I dedicated the book to him in part. But it's the case. Now, does that mean that wine experts are phonies? Not a bit of it. It just means that's the way all of our pleasures take place. They take place within context. You ask a literature professor, you say, I can prove that this is by Shakespeare. And someone else thinks it's by Bakespeare, they have different responses to it. That's the way we live in the world. My real complaint about wine writing isn't that it's phony in any way. I think it's no more than any other kind of criticism. It's that it's totally cut off from the reality of inebriation, right? If you read Robert Parker and you were a Martian and you went back to the head Martian and said, I don't quite understand this. They make these incredibly fine discriminations between the 96 bottle and the 84 bottle, but I don't know why. There would be nothing to tell you that the fundamental social purpose of wine is to get high, is to be an intoxicant. And I think that's another kind of Puritanism that we should reject. Paul Draper, the wonderful California winemaker, says, I wish people drank wine more and tasted it less. And I think that's a nice motto.
Another thing you write about is coffee in the book. And I wonder what you make of the kind of coffee culture we have here in Seattle, which is sort of different than coffee at the end of the meal, it seems like to me.
Yes. Well, it's in some ways, isn't it? And I just had great Seattle coffee. Mm. In some ways, it goes back to the beginnings of coffee culture in 18th century France, when people went to coffee houses to drink coffee and chocolate, too, by the way, alone. And it plays this wonderful role of being both, it's a stimulant to conversation. And that's one of the roles that coffee has always played. You know, there's a great German philosopher, Habermas, who insists that coffee in the coffee house was the crucial ingredient in the Enlightenment. Because it's only when you have people who are stimulated to talk, not in a big public space, again, and not just at home, but in a semi-public space, like a coffee house, then you begin to make the kind of ties and associations that build up the civic capital you need for democracy.
Is the coffee experience or the cafe experience different than the restaurant experience, which is a little bit more splintered and alienating?
Yes, I think that's true. Most people would say it's the restaurant experience is more kind of the classic middle-class experience, and the coffee house is more kind of classic, what should we call it, a bohemian artistic experience. I think that's not a false thing. But the great joys, but just think how wonderfully America has been transformed by coffee coming from Seattle, because for the first time, you have a real coffee house culture in America. You walk into any Starbucks in New York City, and you cannot get a seat because people are busy talking, flirting, writing, working. That's a fabulous thing for a little bean to have done.
I have exactly 1 minute left, but it's not a recipe book, but you do have some recipes in here.
I
and
do.
I wonder if you can give us maybe not the whole recipe, but a sense of this recipe that you have for lamb, how you cook it.
Oh, I do lamb two ways. I love to roast lamb in very high heat. And then in the last 20 minutes, I pile anchovies and bacon, my two favorite additives, right on top. Let them brown on top and then deglaze the pan with white wine. Makes a great simple lamb. The other way I like to do it is to slow cook it, braise it with cinnamon and saffron and some dried apricots in a kind of North African way. They're both sublime ways and very simple.
Adam Gopnik's new book is The Table Comes First, Family, France, and the Meaning of Food. From KUOW, 94.9 Seattle, I'm David Hyde.